entered the facility, heavily armed, immediately started shooting everybody.
It was a local man dressed in battle fatigues who declared, "I have killed 1,000, I'm going to kill 1,000 more." 41-year-old James Huberty reportedly walked into the restaurant carrying a semi-automatic rifle and two other weapons, enough ammunition to last 2 hours. Witnesses inside said he fired wildly into the unsuspecting crowd gathered for a quick evening meal. He fired through windows, hitting people in the street. He fired at men, women, children, and babies.
Bullets fly, leaving a local family scared to be in their own home. Tonight, investigators say hate was driving the man who pulled the trigger.
Deputies say last month, someone opened fire on the Hashems because they're Muslim.
And I need to know who hate us that much, who wants us to die.
Authorities in California are urging Jewish schools and temples to stay alert following a shooting at a synagogue in L.A.
The attack happened in the same area of Bushwick where another Hispanic immigrant was killed.
Vera left a food pantry here at his church in Lower Manhattan, carrying his groceries. He biked across the Williamsburg Bridge and into Bushwick, where police say he was allegedly struck in the head, then thrown off his bike as three black males yelled anti-Mexican slurs.
On the left-hand side of your screen, you can see the two attackers shove and punch Jack Price, the openly gay victim, now in a medically induced coma. The attack accelerates, with both suspects flailing their arms at the helpless 49-year-old.
There was utter pandemonium outside the university building as ambulances carted away the injured. Police have now confirmed 14 students dead, all women. Another dozen people were hurt, caught in a rampage that witnesses called a human hunt, with the gunman yelling, "I want women."
Elliot Layton, anthropologist.
There's an interesting perspective that comes out of many studies in psychiatric anthropology, which suggests that mental illness is not just a standardized invarying thing, like diabetes, for example. Diabetes is always the same wherever you are in the world, but mental illness seems to take different forms. Once a person takes leave of reality, once a person abandons the ship of fools, the form that the psychosis takes is often dictated or at least shaped by the dominant culture. Thus, for example, in traditional Ojibwe society, where there was a belief that once a person went insane, this is the Wendigo psychosis, that he or she might eat human flesh. And thus a proportion of people who, feeling that they've left reality, no longer feeling control, begin to act out the particular form of psychosis that their culture is aware of. Multiple murderers tend to differ from the conventional single murderers. The ordinary murderer is very uniform everywhere in the industrial world. He's very much a bottom of the working class figure. He's addicted to drugs or alcohol. He has no education or professional qualifications. This is the sort of person who, in a fit of rage, kills a friend or a lover. Multiple murders are a little different. They tend to be more edging towards the middle class in their origins and in their aspirations. And a part of their agenda, of their motivation, is that they devoutly wish to join a higher class but come to feel excluded. In the case of James Huberty, the mass murderer who killed more than a dozen people in that long siege at the McDonald's in San Diego, Huberty used to stare from his apartment across the street at McDonald's, which was filled with Mexican immigrants who were seizing control of this fundamental institution, he thought, of American society, who were able to go there and afford to eat when he couldn't. I tried to argue in a succession of books that these kinds of killers, while their acts are deranged and insane, what they themselves are not necessarily so. Rather, they are alienated individuals who wish to end their life in a way that allows them to release their grudge against society for their perceived exclusions. Multiple killers may be statistically rare, but I've tried to argue that they represent central cultural themes. They embody many of the main ideas in their culture, not only the glorification of violence and manly vengeance, but worldly success and worldly ambition, which they feel they've been foiled in. So they're a prime embodiment of their civilization, not a twisted derangement of it. I've also tried to argue that this fundamentally rebellious rather than revolutionary cast to what they're doing, these ghastly killings they perpetrate, are relatively ignored by government institutions charged with regulating society. They typically pay much more attention to real political dangers and spend much less time and energy and money monitoring this small group of killers. Now, I don't believe personally that the answer to psychopathy is to be found in brain-altering chemicals to change the nature of our society in that artificial way. I think what we ought to start doing is teaching people about the dignity and value and the sacredness of human life and teaching people how to behave towards one another. The important thing to understand, however, is while it's interesting to look into the nature of modern society and see its fissures and fractures and stresses through multiple murderers, it should not be considered that these are the primary killers. Governments and politicians are the main killers. Indeed, some scholars have argued that the state's primary function is as mass murderer, to wage war on other states. And that was how they developed. That's the social impetus for the development of the modern state. So it's kind of disturbing. We don't think of the state in that way, but that's what it is. Hitler and Stalin, between them, killed something like more than 100 million peoples, many of them their own peoples. This small-time, personalized vengeance of a few serial killers and mass killers comes to nothing compared to them. The real killers are governments.
Nowhere is frustration and aggression more apparent than in modern-day military training. In her study of Japanese atrocities in China, Iris Chang observed that Japanese troops were subjected to particularly severe abuse prior to their deployment. They were repeatedly slapped for no reason, humiliated in front of their peers, and reduced to a state of impotent rage. It was generally at this point that they would be given a bayonet and instructed to attack the enemy, who was portrayed as a subhuman animal. In America, the same techniques would be adopted, with the emphasis less on physical abuse than verbal.
Look at me right now!
Aye, sir!
You respond with aye, sir, do you understand?
Yes, sir!
Get off my bus right now!
Aye, sir!
Hurry up! Yes, sir. I don't want to do that! Let go! Hurry up!
Was scared. That's pretty much what it boiled down to. You have a recruit that is has no idea what the Marine Corps is about. It's that initial shock treatment to let them know that this isn't a summer camp, this isn't where people are coming to have a good time, that we got a real job down here, and that's making United States Marines.
My family was poor. I mean, we used to live on dirt roads, and you know, we used to wear sandals most of the time. Or, I mean, humble. You know, we used to probably wash our same clothes 2 or 3 times a week because that's basically pretty much what we had. I wanted people to see that, you know, this is where I come from, and look at me now. I'm a Marine. I come from the poor side of town. You know, so anybody else could make it as well. You know, some type of motivation for my little brothers and my little cousins, something they could look forward to.
Frustration aggression is one of the most effective ways of managing a population. By directing a person's rage against selected minorities or outside enemies, the true cause of an individual's frustration can be effectively diverted. Yet in many ways, the theory is a symptom of something deeper. In order to engender real hatred against a particular group, that group must first be feared. And it is in the realm of fear that behaviorism made its most disturbing contribution.
Hobart Maurer, he would be called a neo-behaviorist, and he trained at the Yale Institute of Human Behavior. And he was quite unusual. I think his background was unusual, and he was also an unusually perceptive and sensitive man. And one of the first and most significant experiments he did was called a preparatory set, in which he had a human being lie down, or usually it was a student, lie down and be attached to electrodes that would deliver a shock whenever a light went on. And then so he would shine the light and then shock the student. And at that point, several people elected to discontinue the experiment. But those who persisted, he would then vary the experiment by showing the light and then not shocking them, or showing the light and shocking them. He would sort of make it unpredictable. And he discovered that people's state of anxiety and fear actually increased when the shock didn't come, when they were just waiting for a shock to come, or when they didn't know if a shock would ever come. And he said it actually created an atmosphere of pervasive fear and anxiety, and he even called it dread or terror.
We have to remind ourselves that we are facing an enemy that is planning all over this world, and it turns out planning inside our country to come here and kill us.
And he said that atmosphere could be ratcheted up progressively the more the experiment continued and the more unpredictable the shocks were, so that after a while, when the shock came, the pain actually was experienced as relief and almost pleasure by the subject. He called it a nervous breakdown, or what he described in another part of the article as the ultimate demoralization of behavior. What he extracted from this experiment was the idea that there was such a thing as a coercive stimulus that could actually be used to create an environment of dread or terror or anxiety from a low to a high level, and that the scientists could actually, it was almost as if they were turning the volume on a stereo, they could decide how much of that atmosphere, how intense they would like it to be.
Needless to say, a creature in a highly fearful environment will be eager to escape to a new environment. This includes human beings. Maurer suggested that new behavior patterns could be quickly created through his techniques. The prospect of creating new behavior patterns quickly and efficiently became an obsession during the Cold War, when the Central Intelligence Agency assumed dominance in the field of mind control experimentation. During the Cold War, the national security state would take the logic of power to its logical conclusion. Known under the umbrella name MK-Ultra, mind control experimentation by the CIA would abandon any pretense to morality, leading to a nightmarish search for the holy grail of social engineering, a fully controlled, fully obedient human being.
A quote from Aldous Huxley: "The nature of the universe is such that ends can never justify the means. On the contrary, the means always determine the end."
Coming up on Secrets of the Dead, as World War II winds down, the Allies race to capture Hitler's best scientists and technology.
The Black Book had names, targets, places, people. The most important were the scientists, the German scientists.
Searching for rockets, planes, nuclear bombs, and the masterminds behind them. Each side wants the advantage for the looming Cold War. The hunt for Nazi scientists, next on Secrets of the Dead.
The majority of media on the subject of Project Paperclip has centered on German rocket scientists recruited by the United States to prevent the Soviet Union from establishing military supremacy. Hollywood has dealt with the topic in much the same way, often adding humor to the equation. Seldom discussed with equal candor is the recruitment of Nazi scientists who specialized in human experimentation. Among them were Kurt Blom, who tested sarin nerve gas on prisoners at Auschwitz, and Hermann Becker Freising, who conducted fatal experiments at Dachau.
Colin Ross, psychiatrist.
The American people got hold of X number of German scientists, but they immediately ran into a problem. Many of these scientists were classified as war criminals because of their activities during the war, and therefore were not eligible for State Department visas and could not be brought into the United States. So what the CIA did was create several of these different programs, including Paperclip, and their purpose was to, number one, recruit these scientists, and then number two, bring them into the U.S. while routing them around the State Department visa requirements. A well-known doctor who came in under Paperclip was Dr. Albertus Strughold, who did experiments during the Second World War that were full Nazi atrocity-type experiments. For instance, they were interested in the effects of high altitude on human beings, so they built a special chamber. They would put a gypsy or homosexual or a Jew or whoever it might be into the chamber and suddenly drop the pressure down to the equivalent of 60,000 feet. This obviously was excruciating and caused the person to die. And then they would take the guy out of the chamber, dunk his head underwater, and cut his skull open underwater to see if there was air bubbles coming out of the arteries in his brain. And so, you know, they did dozens and dozens of experiments of this kind. So this guy was brought over under paperclip, became the father of aviation medicine in the United States, worked at an Air Force base in San Antonio, amongst other locations, has a library named after him at one of the Air Force bases in San Antonio, and the Texas State Legislature declared an Alberta Strewcoal Day in honor of him back in the 70s.
Whether Nazi scientists participated in experiments on Americans after their recruitment by American intelligence remains unknown. What is known is that such experiments became a matter of routine. Some of the studies were relatively harmless, if unethical. In 1966, the U.S. Army's Special Operations Division dispensed a non-toxic bacillus to the New York City subway system by way of cracked light bulbs. Other experiments were not so harmless.
1946. University of Rochester researchers inject human subjects with uranium in order to study how much they can tolerate before their kidneys become damaged. 1949. Mentally retarded children at the Fernald School in Massachusetts are given radioactive oatmeal in order to test the effects on the human body. 1950. The U.S. Navy secretly sprays a cloud of bacteria over San Francisco. The Navy later claims that the experiment was harmless. Many residents became ill with severe infections, leading to at least one death. The U.S. Army releases a toxic chemical called zinc cadmium sulfide over Minneapolis and other cities. High rates of pneumonia, infant mortality, and cancer occur near dispersal sites. Army doctors study children at local schools, noting the health effects. 1953. The U.S. Atomic Energy Commission sponsors iodine studies at the University of Iowa. Pregnant women are given 100 to 200 microcuries of iodine-131 to determine at what stage radioactive iodine crosses the placental barrier. The aborted fetuses are later studied. 1955. CIA conducts a biowarfare test where bacteria is released into the Tampa Bay area. A sharp rise in whooping cough results, causing 12 deaths. Details of the experiment remain classified. 1956. The U.S. military releases mosquitoes infected with yellow fever over poor communities in Savannah, Georgia and Haven Park, Florida. Results include stillbirths, encephalitis, typhoid, and several deaths. Following each test, Army agents posing as public health officials test victims for effects. 1957, Operation Plum Bob. The U.S. military detonates bombs at the Nevada test site, northwest of Las Vegas. An estimated 32,000 cases of cancer occur among U.S. civilians due to the experiments. No one is warned.
It was in this environment that U.S. mind control experimentation came into being.
Christopher Simpson, author of The Science of Coercion.
At the end of the war, the OSS was disbanded, and the same personnel really came together and formed the CIA in 1947. And the first documented CIA mind control programs are Bluebird and Artichoke. Bluebird was signed into operation by the director of the CIA in April of 1950, which is 3 months before the start of the Korean War. So all claims that CIA and U.S. interested mind control was purely reactive, purely defensive, and only in reaction to what the communist Chinese were doing to downed pilots during the Korean War, all of that is not true disinformation, clearly disproven by the documents. Artichoke and Bluebird started in 1950, ran into the mid-50s, and kind of overlapped with and were rolled into MKUltra, which ran till 1963. MKUltra, in turn, was rolled over into MKSearch, which ran to the early 70s. And in the 50s, 60s, there's a variety of other programs, MKNaomi, MKDelta, QK Hilltop, Project Offen. So there's a whole set of these projects. And the documentation basically stops in 1973. All programs since then are still classified.
Of particular interest were Nazi research papers by Dr. Kurt Plattner from Dachau concentration camp. Plattner had found that prisoners, when given high doses of mescaline, openly expressed hatred of their captors while also exhibiting an increased willingness to speak frankly about their own lives.
The dream of MKUltra was to come up with drugs that on the one hand would be sort of an ultimate truth serum, that you could give it to a person and they would tell you the truth about anything that you wanted to hear. And then on the other hand, there would also be some way to wipe a person's mind clean.
Heading up the CIA psychochemical experiments would be Sidney Gottlieb. In 1960, when the agency plotted the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, leftist president of the Congo, it was Gottlieb who personally carried the poison to the agency's chief of station via diplomatic pouch. A 1953 memo from Gottlieb states that MKUltra Subproject 6 is designed to develop a reliable source of lysergic acid derivatives within the U.S. The problem of supply was solved in October 1954, when Eli Lilly and Company, now known for manufacturing Prozac, succeeded in synthesizing LSD.
This pill could solve all of your problems. It's called Prozac, and it may mean the end of depression as we know it.
A special memorandum was rushed to CIA Director Alan Dulles on October 26th. And an unlimited supply of the drug was now available to be purchased by, and in some cases used against, the American taxpayer. As with the behaviorists, they started with animals. Here, we see millions of years of evolution turned upside down when a cat is given LSD. Soldiers came next. One of the first major studies was conducted at the Edgewood Chemical Facility in Maryland, where approximately 7,000 U.S. soldiers served as unwitting guinea pigs. They were given drugs such as LSD, mescaline, BZ, and PCP, then instructed to perform various tasks. Looking back at early behaviorist experiments, the analogies were obvious. Under the CIA and the Pentagon, what was good enough for rats was good enough for the U.S. Armed Forces. More than 1,000 of the soldiers emerged with mental health problems. Some attempted suicide. No compensation was offered. In a later experiment, and with the full approval of the National Institute of Health, Gottlieb arranged funding for a project at the Addiction Research Center in Lexington. Heroin addicts, mainly young black men, were kept on LSD for an incredible 77 days, a feat described by the center's director, Harris Isbell, as the most amazing demonstration of drug tolerance I have ever seen. But they would not stop there.
Segment three this evening is titled The Children and the CIA. We've learned a lot of unknown activities of the CIA in years past, some of them disturbing, to say the least. Tonight, we'll learn of the agency's interest in children. Paul Altmaier of our investigative unit has assembled these facts.
These are home movies taken in the 1950s at a European camp of the Children's International Summer Village, a program designed to bring together children from around the world for a better understanding of one another. NBC News has learned that the CIA was studying these youngsters, some as young as 11, as possible future recruits. The studies took place at summer camps in Hennefest, Norway and Vienna, Austria, in 1959 and 1960. According to CIA documents we have examined, this was Subproject 103 of the agency's top-secret MKUltra program. San Antonio, Texas. NBC News has also learned that the CIA paid for a study of adolescents here and in two other Texas cities, Austin and El Paso, in 1958 and 1959. It was a study of how youngsters behave without adult supervision. This study, MKUltra Subproject 102, refers to data being collected on 462 subjects in seven secondary schools. No child is identified by name.
Colin Ross, psychiatrist.
One of the most revered child psychiatrists in the entire 20th century of American psychiatry was Dr. Loretta Bender. She had a full-page obituary in the American Journal of Psychiatry And that only happens occasionally. You have to be really a high-ranking person to have a full-page obituary. And she's famous for the Bender Gestalt test, which is a widely used psychological test. So not everybody in the mental health field knows exactly who she is, but all psychology graduate students have heard of the Bender Gestalt. And she was a child psychiatrist charged with the care and treatment of children. And she operated at Creedmoor State Hospital in New York in the 60s. Her funding source is not stated in her papers. So where she got the LSD from and whether she was directly funded by the military or the CIA is not documented. But she attended many CIA-sponsored LSD symposia, talked with, was on panels with, interacted with most of the leading CIA and military LSD contractors. So I would say it's unbelievable that she didn't know that all of this was basically run by the CIA and the military. And what she did, again, is not the mad scientist hidden in the basement somewhere. These are papers in leading psychiatry journals where she, as the author, describes children as young as 5 getting LSD, mescaline, psilocybin, other hallucinogens in street-level type doses for days, weeks, months, and in some cases years at a time. Under the rationale that somehow this is going to be helpful treatment. Again, no real follow-up. How many of these kids went psychotic? How did it affect their chromosomes? What was with their mental health from there on? So this is the kind of experimentation that you would think would be impossible. It would never happen. Somebody who claimed that would just be in need of treatment themselves. But not only is it documented, it was published in the literature, and nobody seemed to be upset. Nobody complained to the American Psychiatric Association. Nobody reported it to anybody. It was just business as usual.
The use of children in barbaric mind control experiments shows an evolution from the early behaviorists to the CIA mind doctors. Once the doctrine of national security had been invoked, ethical considerations received little or no attention. Almost anything could be justified by claiming the communists might be engaged in similar activities.
During the Korean War, in 1953, during the cessation of the war, American soldiers were returned home who had been prisoners of war in China. They started exhibiting very strange behavior. When the boat neared the shore, they were not very happy to come home. Even the sight of their mother's outstretched arms seemingly failed to move them. They were sort of stone-faced. They would start spouting communist propaganda. Some of them had seemed to have been converted to communism, and even 21 Air Force personnel had been persuaded to stay in Korea and, you know, start families there.
My name is Harold Webb from West Palm Beach, Florida.
My name is Aaron Wilson from Urania, Louisiana. This is a very happy moment for me, for now I'm free.
In smaller or large ways, they had collaborated or cooperated or allowed themselves to be coerced by the enemy. Many sociologists and psychiatrists and psychologists who both worked for the army or worked for institutions like universities were brought together in teams to study why this was happening. And one of the people who headed one of the teams was named Louis Jolyon West. And he was a talented American psychiatrist who was working for the army, and he headed a team that studied the returned soldiers from the, what was called Operation Little Switch, and these soldiers were displaying some of that behavior, and so they were trying to figure out what exactly had happened. They concluded that it was nothing, that this, if it was brainwashing, it was not the typical kind of notion of what people think brainwashing is, which is some magical hocus pocus where the person loses their mind and, like changing the software on a computer, one day they're good old-fashioned Americans and the next day they're these kind of rabid communists. But instead they were describing a process that much more resembled slow, steady, classical behavioral conditioning. So they came up with the words DDD for debility, dependency, and dread. Stability was basically that they'd been put in a situation where their wounds weren't treated and their health was low and they weren't fed very well, so they kind of developed a chronic debility, and sometimes they developed a condition that other soldiers called give-up-itis, where they would just simply lie down and refuse to take food and water and just die. And the second was dependency, that they were these soldiers were made to be extremely dependent on their captors for any kind of reward or any kind of even anything resembling a small comfort or luxury or even just food to keep them alive, they were dependent on their captors, so that created in a way a kind of intimate bond. And then the third D was for dread, which was an atmosphere of fear and terror and constant unpredictability, where the prisoner would never be sure what was going to happen next. They could be kept awake for 48 hours or a week, they could be given a drug or not, they could be given food or not, they never knew when that would be coming, and they never knew if their captors would be treating them decently or not, so there was an atmosphere of this kind of extreme unpredictability. And all of that together was what they called DDD, which they were said could basically be explained through behavioral principles. And what it resulted in was a dismantling of the self, or a demoralization of, to go back to Maurer's idea, the ultimate demoralization of behavior.
While the purpose of the study was to find out about communist brainwashing techniques, CIA documents show that the agency was interested in developing mind control methods of its own.
Jolly West served as a defense witness in the trial of Patty Hearst, who was kidnapped by the self-proclaimed Symbionese Liberation Army and brainwashed into robbing banks.
There's some feeling among experts, and particularly her family, that Patricia Hearst was brainwashed by the Symbionese Liberation Army. One thing cited to substantiate that is that two known SLA members, including the slain leader Donald DeFries, were inmates at a California prison where sophisticated methods of mind control are practiced on some prisoners.
And drugs are a vital part of therapy here. Everything from sleeping pills to Prolixin, a heavy tranquilizer used to control schizophrenics. What concerns the critics of prison therapy, however, is the danger that the tools of modern psychiatry can also be applied to a captive prison population for convenience instead of treatment. Not to make sick inmates better, but simply to make them behave.
In his 1973 State of the State message, then-Governor of California, Ronald Reagan, announced plans for the establishment of a biomedical facility at Vacaville. It would be called the Center for the Study of the Reduction of Violence and would use techniques pioneered by Jose Delgado. Delgado had gained worldwide fame for stopping a charging bull in its tracks by using a gadget he called a stimulceiver, a remote-controlled device that triggered electric impulses in the animal's brain.
Neurophysicist Dr. Jose Delgado was financed by the Office of Naval Research.
Grainy but spectacular footage of a charging bull at a red cape, which appears to suddenly stop and spin round when the holder of the cape presses a button on a wireless gadget.
Were you sure that that bull was going to stop as it approached you when you pushed the right button?
Scientists always should have faith in science. I have faith in science.
Recently released CIA documents refer to the feasibility of remote control of animals and that special investigations will be conducted toward the application of selected elements of these techniques to man.
In Delgado's papers, he's basically implanting electrodes in the brains of human beings and experimental animals. And in one of these papers, he refers to the animals as mechanical toys. In the Harvard team, there's pictures of a 16-year-old girl. In one picture, she's staring off into nowhere with a bland, empty expression on her face. In another picture, she's strumming on her guitar. In another picture, she's furiously pounding on the wall, all totally controlled by which button is pushed in the neurotransmitter box. When you open somebody's brain like this and you put an electrode in and you keep it in for a long period of time, you're exposing that person to the risk of brain infections, meningitis, seizures, and death.
For prison officials at Vacaville, the idea of controlling inmates through remote control was a tempting prospect, and drafting the outlines of the new program was none other than Jolly West. West's proposal recommended psychosurgery as a tool for controlling prison populations and crime. Remarkably, he also recommended using schools in Chicano and African American neighborhoods to screen for possible, quote, genetic defects. The project was terminated, but only after public outrage forced officials to backtrack. West's research would lead to new dreams of what he called the psychophysiology of conditioning. West noticed that DDD bore an interesting resemblance to post-lobotomy syndrome, as well as altered states of consciousness produced by certain drugs, hypnosis, and mental diseases like schizophrenia. In all of these cases, the notion of self, of free will, is displaced by something more obscure. In West's words, the patient loses all recollection of the fact that he formerly possessed a space-time image which served to explain the events of the day to him. With these ideas in mind, large funds were poured into the Allen Memorial Institute in Montreal, headed by Scottish-born psychiatrist Ewan Cameron. A future president of the World Psychiatric Association, Cameron set out to actualize the new vision of total control. He would create real-life blank slates out of his patients by wiping their minds clean and destroying their very notions of self. From there, new behavior patterns could conceivably be built upon the wreckage of their former identities.
The Allen Memorial Institute, at the time, was probably the leading academic center of psychiatry in Canada, attached to McGill University. And the chairman of McGill University, we're in the 50s into the 60s now, was Dr. Ewan Cameron, originally born in Scotland, emigrated to Canada. He had money from the CIA under MKUltra to do two basic things, a kind of brainwashing in which he would, for many months in a row, administer massive, massive amounts of electric shock to a person, Linda McDonald. She got over 100 electroshock treatments in a period of 4 or 5 months. Each time, the button was pushed 6 times instead of once. So the electricity delivered to her brain was over 600 normal electroshock treatments. Also, people would get prolonged sleep induced by barbiturates, tranquilizers, antipsychotics, and so on. So this is the depatterning. And what would happen from this massive shock and drug-induced kind of sleep is what happened to Linda McDonald. She went into the hospital in the spring slightly depressed, otherwise perfectly normal, functioning, intact person with 5 kids. By August, she was incontinent of urine and feces, unable to feed herself, didn't know her name, didn't know where she was, didn't know what year it was, didn't recognize her husband, and didn't recognize her children. So it's a complete wiping clean of the brain.
They shipped me up to what they called the sleep room, and they gave me all of these electroconvulsive shock treatments and megadoses of drugs and LSD and all of that, and I have no memory of any of that. Nothing of that time in the Allen Memorial or any of my life previous to that. All gone. Wiped.
When she was released, she had to very laboriously learn how to play guitar, how to boil an egg, how to keep track of her kids. And this was the purpose of the experimentation. And obviously the CIA was interested in this only for one purpose, which is if they had somebody and they wanted to wipe out their memories, would this method work? And Ewan Cameron proved that it could. Building up the new identity was called psychic driving. And one of the techniques was they played either in Ewan Cameron's voice, one of the other doctor's voices, or in the person's own voice, they'd play these tape loops literally tens of thousands of times over and over and over and over, delivering whatever message it was they wanted the person to believe. One of the disinformation cover stories about all of this is, well, first of all, it never happened, but then when it comes to light and there's lawsuits and publicity, then the next level of cover story is, well, that was back then, that was a different time, different standards applied. We wouldn't do that today. But actually, in fact, all the ethical standards of 2010 applied absolutely at the end of the Second World War and applied back in ancient Rome and Greece. They were clearly unethical, immoral, destructive, unprofessional, harmful to the brains and to the lives of the subjects. In some of the experiments, not the ones at McGill, but other ones, as reported by the doctors in papers in psychiatric journals, in some of the experiments people died. In other experiments they went psychotic. They were then treated with shock therapy. So long-lasting psychotic reactions, worsening of symptoms, creation of new symptoms, and in some cases death, are described by the doctors in their own papers where they're discussing the research. But during the Cold War, and this is up until the early 70s when the documentation stops and everything is classified, there was extensive systematic, pervasive, structured contracting by the leading figures of psychiatry and the leading medical schools with the CIA at the top secret clearance level. The typical universities on the list would include Cornell, Harvard, Yale, Tulane, UCLA, the University of Minnesota, Denver University, and so on. So it was not just some mad scientist in a basement somewhere.
Therapeutically speaking, the experiments of the MK-Ultra psychiatrists were a complete failure. Yet, they were useful in at least one respect. The manual is called Kubark. Dated 1963, it is a how-to guide compiled by the CIA for interrogating suspects. In other words, a torture manual. Referring explicitly to early behaviorist experiments, as well as Cameron's studies at McGill, it describes a phenomenon whereby the deprivation of stimuli induces regression by depriving the subject's mind of contact with an outer world and thus forcing it upon itself. As the interrogate slips back from maturity toward a more infantile state, his learned or structured personality traits fall away. Rather than red-hot pincers, iron maidens, and racks, the tools of choice would become the stress position, sensory deprivation, and electroshock.
The manuals that they wrote, which were based on the earlier behavioral experiments, were directly adopted during the War on Terror. What happened was, during the 70s and 80s, these manuals had spread in Latin America and other places for use in counterinsurgency movements, and these techniques had never really gone out of favor. So if you look at Guantanamo Bay, as of 5 years into the war, there had been 10 to 20,000 interrogations that took place there. So it's, you hear about the extreme interrogations, but what was really going on was a kind of routinization of the process of interrogating people and creating these environments in which they never knew if it was day or night, if it was going to be cold or hot, if they would be subjected to loud music or terrible, babies crying or Sesame Street, or that it was a completely unpredictable environment that created an atmosphere of stability, dread, and dependency. And that also is linked to the importing of people called behavioral science consultants, or BISCITs, who were often anthropologists or psychologists who would come and kind of oversee and monitor these interrogations.
Many decades later, the U.S. government's mind control projects retain an aura of mystery. Former CIA Director Richard Helms claims to have shredded most of the remaining documentation. Yet Miles Copeland, a former CIA officer, claims the Congressional Subcommittee, which went into this, got only the barest glimpse of the U.S. government's attempt to control the human mind. Whatever the case, exotic mind control techniques would not be required for the ultimate goal of controlling the opinions and behavior of the American public. The answer would come in the form of a small, flickering box. The behaviorist Ivan Pavlov was the first scientist to explain why moving images are so attractive to human beings. We instinctively react to any sudden or novel visual stimuli because of our biological orienting system. In evolutionary terms, this was and is necessary both for exploration of our environment and for defense against potential predators. Television not only entertains the mind, it relaxes the body. This has been confirmed by EEG readings of viewers' brainwaves as they watch television programs and advertising. In the hands of skilled media professionals, moving images create an effect roughly akin to hypnosis, producing passivity, a lowered level of alertness, and increased suggestibility.
But some will get through to your home.
During the Cold War and beyond, television programming would increasingly resemble an experiment in fear-based conditioning applied on a global scale. The thesis of John B. Watson that fear, not love, is the guiding force in human society would no longer be confined to the realm of theory. It would become our reality.
Scott Noble dedicates this film to his aunt, Nancy Noble. As a teenager, she was interned at the Allen Memorial Institute in Montreal, where she was subjected to CIA-sponsored mind control experimentation. She never recovered. Well, that entire film is highly recommended. It's been made by Scott Noble, who's put it out in the public domain. So if you want to make a showing of that to friends or family, then it's available for download from this show's webpage, www.unwelcomeguests.net/530. It seems to me important that people get this perspective on the 20th century. It's not something that I ever had in the 20th century, because I never had access to media sources, information by individuals. Much more of my information was organized through committees, through hierarchies, with agendas to promote. It's an open question. Is love more powerful than fear in human society? I think the result, if there is one, will be the result of every individual's efforts, everyone's individual facing up to that question. Are they going to be manipulated by fear, or are they going to respond to love? The metaphor of the matrix is a helpful one. People are used by a larger social machine for what it can get out of them, and by the millions are cast aside when it no longer serves the machine's purposes. Another metaphor I've used is that of the Truman Show. Life in the so-called developed world is materially comfortable. Materially, you could say it's advantaged, but in another important sense, it's not free, because information is so highly controlled, because activity is so highly circumscribed, and because there are barriers erected which attempt to divide and conquer people, both within populations and within individuals. The idea of professionalism, professional with a terrible triple meaning. On the one hand, it's good to be professional because it's a higher quality. Think about office professional or office home edition. On another hand, a professional is somebody who works for money. And another meaning of professionalism is the ability to disregard your personal values, to do whatever it is whoever is paying you has asked you to do. So to put those three meanings into one word reveals a distressed and divided nature. I like talking about work-life balance, as if work is not life. Hunter-gatherers probably have trouble with that one. It's the same way that they have trouble with disaffected labour, or, for that matter, have trouble with the idea of what money is and social power. Many of the non-hierarchical societies, hunter-gatherers typically, lived in conditions which the modern human has been trained to reject as uncivilized, undeveloped, and yet their life had an integrity which is denied to so many people living in material luxury. Their lives are not divided between times when they receive money and therefore have to put up with all sorts of things from people they otherwise wouldn't, and times when, as a customer, they're paying and insist on their rights. Now, I'm dedicating this show to a brother of a friend of mine. You know who you are, no names here, who is studying human resource management. And management always strikes me as a euphemism for control, but in this instance, it could be a euphemism for exploitation. How many good, kind-hearted, normal people are studying how to maximize the value of the human resources at their disposal? Notice the language there. Maximizing value sounds good, doesn't it? We all want to have lots of value, want to be valuable, which in the so-called developed world is synonymous with money. Well, according to George Lakoff, then from the moment we realize what money is, there's an equivalence built up which is deeper than words, a metaphorical equivalence which actually has a neural representation. So we want to maximize the value of the human resources. You don't want to let resources go to waste, do you? I'm using deceptive frames from one point of view. If you can hear that, then this is a good sign, I think, because another person hearing it might say, yeah, of course. Of course you want to maximize your human resources. And if we think about it as an economic problem, you're going to have to optimize this. You're going to maximize what you get out of it. If you're in that frame, you're already in the structure of divide and conquer. Money, which measures only one dimension, cuts you off. It cuts off your thinking from all the other dimensions of life. The modern fiat money sets up a hierarchy, because you have the money masters, people who can issue money out of nothing with their quantitative easing gambit, and then you have everyone else who has to borrow money from the banks, and of course, overall, they're in debt, because they can't create their own money, have to borrow it from the banks. But if you're in a company, what you make, what you sell, what you do, of course, doesn't have only economic consequences. It has social consequences, it has consequences for the environment, it has political consequences. How much of that is relevant? Well, as an individual human being, of course it's relevant, as everybody notices that. But in the frame of economic self-maximization, that's not on the agenda. So in the 20th century, if we have institutions with an agenda to maximize Lebensraum, or increase sales, or promote national security above all else, then that's exactly what they'll do. Ethical consequences, consequences for other people, even the idea of this is what we do, we have a limited mission, and we're going to divide and conquer responsibility, strategy, planning, so that a small number of people are deciding on behalf of a large number of people. Well, if you don't believe in the sort of Nietzschean Übermensch, that some people do have godlike powers who should be in charge, then what's the justification for that? We've heard some of the attempted justifications, and I think the task that is ahead of us in the 21st century is to overturn that meta-narrative about hierarchy, about experts, and films like this one provide us with arguments about why we shouldn't disconnect our head from our heart and run according to our head. The lesson of the 20th century, as chronicled by Scott Noble, is what untold suffering has been caused as a consequence of the attitude of hierarchy disrespecting its role. If you have a decision-making process which involves a very small number of people, then that's a lot of trust, and we know that psychopaths do exist. If we have a decision-making process which has a large number of people, then if a small number of those turn out not to have the integrity we would hope for, the process can still work well. The big lie, it seems to me, behind the hierarchies of the 20th century is that most people are bad, that we can't have a system which gives responsibilities to ordinary people because they'll mess it up. We've got to have a system in which experts are in charge, and we've got to have a system with other experts, privileged people, will monitor what they do. But who's going to watch the watchman? Ah, that'll be where the psychopaths come in. Now, here's a few closing thoughts from the earlier speech by John Taylor Gatto.
School was an important terminal on a production line to create a utopian world resembling a gigantic Epcot Center, or perhaps the Mother Chautauqua of late 19th century fame, a utopia before its time. There was only one important eugenical limitation on this school-created utopia to come. It wasn't intended for everyone, at the most for 20% of the existing population. And out of Johns Hopkins University in 1996 came this chilling piece of supporting data. I'm going to quote, from the Hopkins Report. The American economy has grown massively since the mid-1960s, but workers' real spendable wages are no higher than they were 30 years ago. The purchasing power of a working couple in 1995 was, after inflation was factored in, the same as earned by a single working man 90 years earlier. This steep decline in American common prosperity then forced both parents from home and forced their kids into the managed world of daycare and extended schooling. And although you and I have been harangued endlessly, century-long, that enlarging the scope of schooling would cause wealth to be more evenly spread, exactly the reverse has occurred. Wealth was 250% more concentrated by 1998 than it was in 1898. I don't mean to be inflammatory, he said, but it's as if government school has made people dumber, not brighter, made families weaker, not stronger, has ruined formal religion with its hard sell exclusion of God, has set the class structure in stone by dividing children into classes and setting them against one another, and has been midwife to an alarming concentration of wealth and power in the hands of a fraction of our national community. Real school reform would have to overthrow a powerful form of mental conditioning which has taken a century to implant. To one degree or another, all of us have been indoctrinated in a variety of ways to believe that the American experiment, which promised ordinary people sovereignty over their own lives, was wrong-headed and childish. Real school reform would have to defeat the belief, learned in school and reinforced through the media, that ordinary people are too stupid, too irresponsible, too childish to be trusted to look out for themselves. When children are encouraged to run wild in school and to become stupid there, this poisonous lesson is hammered home for the rest of us day after day. We've all experienced it. No wonder we all believe it. The premises of scientific schooling seem impossible to dispute, so thoroughly have they been demonstrated by the form of forced schools which corporations and the federal government imposed on us a century ago. After all, why should hopelessly ignorant people be allowed to make decisions, even intimate personal ones like how to raise their own children? Certified experts are available who know vastly more about everything and anything. Thus has the Protestant Reformation, whose brightest product was America, been thrown on the scrap heap, because if there's any bedrock of the Protestant Reformation, it was Luther's declaration, every man his own priest.
Now, that's where we're going to have to leave John Taylor Gatto. The entire speech is available for download at unwelcomeguest.net/530. And of course, you can also download Scott Noble's film, Human Resources, from the same location. It's not too late to contribute your voice to the forthcoming episode, Doom Deconstructed, on the essay about the collapse of industrial society. If you're interested in that, unwelcomeguests.net/collapse, or just go to the cover page and follow the link. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Will.